34 years ago, I happened to be at a dinner party in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, when I was introduced to a man with an unusual name, Abdullah Filby. I commented that he had the same surname as one of the most famous spies in history, Kim Philby. Abdullah responded, unexpectedly, that Kim was his half-brother. He told me that their father had been the personal physician to King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, and that for a lifetime of dedication, the king had given their father Saudi citizenship. The elder Philby converted to Islam, married a Saudi woman, had a second family, and lived out his remaining days in comfort in Riyadh. Quote, "But we don't talk about Kim," he said. That's an ongoing theme. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. We're not going to talk about Kim Philby today. His story is well known. He spied for years on behalf of the Soviet Union, even after rising to be the director of Britain's MI6 spy agency. But lots and lots of people know that story. Today, we're going to tell you a spy story that you likely have never heard before. It's the story of Charles Howard Dick Ellis. He was MI6's top intelligence officer in the United States during World War II. Dick Ellis was born in Australia in 1895 and was a self-taught and self-trained classical cellist. He went to England on a scholarship in 1914 and almost immediately enlisted as a private in the British Army. He fought in France during World War I and was decorated for his bravery. He returned to England, was promoted to the rank of captain, and transferred to South and then Central Asia. He was eventually promoted to the rank of colonel. He joined the foreign ministry and enrolled in Oxford University, where he studied Russian and German. In 1921, Ellis joined MI6 and was sent on his first assignment to Constantinople, the first of many, many foreign assignments. Spending much of the 1930s in London, Ellis was put in charge of MI6 wiretaps on the German embassy there, translating conversations between Adolf Hitler and Joachim von Ribbentrop for the British government. It was in 1940 that Ellis's import grew dramatically. He was transferred to New York to be the second-ranking British intelligence officer there. He helped the FBI hone its counterintelligence techniques and provided American General William Wild Bill Donovan with the blueprint for what became the Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor organization to the CIA. Ellis later learned that the Japanese were planning to bomb Pearl Harbor, and he warned President Franklin Roosevelt of the impending attack through his son, Jimmy Roosevelt. President Harry Truman later awarded Ellis with the American Legion of Merit for his service to the United States during World War II. Ellis even went on to co-found the Australian Secret Intelligence Service on behalf of MI6, and he finally returned to England in 1954. Ellis was given more medals than we can name here, and he was seen as one of the greatest intelligence professionals in the history of the United Kingdom. He retired in the mid-1950s, but the story doesn't end there. When Kim Philby defected to the Soviet Union in 1963 after slipping out of a dinner party in Beirut, a joint MI5-MI6 investigation headed by the legendary intelligence officer Peter Wright investigated Ellis and a number of other retired officials. In an interview with Wright's so-called fluency committee, Ellis allegedly made a confession that he had provided intelligence to the Nazis before the war. He denied ever having otherwise engaged in espionage counter to British interests. But authors, including Wright, have subsequently accused Ellis, posthumously, of course, of having been a triple agent. They allege that not only was he secretly working for the Nazis, but that he was also working for the Soviet Union at the same time, something that his daughter has staunchly and steadfastly denied. Well, there's a new book that has just been published that gets to the bottom of these allegations. The Eagle in the Mirror, The Greatest Spy Story Never Told, was written by award-winning international best-selling author Jesse Fink. He joins us today. Jesse, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
Jesse, where do we even begin with this complicated story? I guess the best place to begin is, of course, at the beginning. So give us an overview of Dick Ellis's career. What made him attractive to MI6? He had no formal training or education. Why did MI6 think he would make a good spy?
Well, Dick Ellis was born in Australia in 1895. He had a pretty tough childhood. His mother died when he was about 2 or 3 years old, and he was shuttled around farms up and down the sort of the east coast of Australia because his father essentially couldn't take care of him. And he sort of came under the wing of a sort of a kindly schoolmaster who started educating Dick, and Dick sort of went to night classes at university in Melbourne and managed to get a scholarship to the UK. And then he went out to the UK in 1914, sort of planning to become a student. And of course, the First World War broke out. And he was, you know, quite a decorated soldier. He was injured sort of multiple times on the Western Front. But while he was convalescing in sort of military hospital, he started studying Russian and became quite fluent in Russian. And obviously this was of much interest to the British intelligence service, and they wanted people who had a great facility for languages. And Dick Ellis eventually ended up speaking about 9 languages. So he was very useful to British intelligence between the wars, because obviously he could be sort of sent off to French-speaking countries, German-speaking countries, and he had a great facility for Russian. So, the main target of British intelligence between the wars was the Soviet Union. So he was very useful.
Ellis was a star in the United States during World War II. He trained J. Edgar Hoover's FBI in counterintelligence techniques. He showed Wild Bill Donovan how to create an intelligence service from the ground up. He was close to 2 presidents, and he forged a friendship with one of the most difficult men in Washington, James Jesus Angleton, who later became the CIA's first deputy director for counterintelligence. There was no indication during those years that he was anything other than a patriotic British intelligence professional. And then we see reports of a so-called confession. Several authors have written about it, but was it an actual confession? Could it have been a transcribed misunderstanding, or could Ellis maybe have been trying to protect somebody?
Yeah, well, this is essentially sort of cutting to the, you know, the core mystery of Dick Ellis is what exactly he supposedly confessed to in 1965. So this came a couple of years after Kim Philby defected to the Soviet Union. And of course, the intelligence agencies of Great Britain and the United States were, you know, roundly embarrassed by the defection of Philby. And they were convinced that there were other Soviet moles in their midst. And so they went through, old files. They went through interrogation reports of Nazis that had been arrested after the Second World War and who had been interrogated. And in one of these particular reports, there was a Nazi officer who mentioned a Captain Ellis, no first name, just Captain Ellis, who had been a source for the Abwehr, the Nazi military intelligence service. And this report had sort of ended up on the desk of none other than Kim Philby back in 1946. And someone had asked him, you know, who is this Ellis? And Kim Philby had responded that he had no idea and that no further action needed to be taken. So in the context of the 1960s, 2 years after Philby had defected, people were looking at this file thinking, why did Kim Philby say that he didn't know Dick Ellis when the two of them worked together? And why had the file essentially been buried? So Ellis sort of came under sort of intense suspicion and was called into an interrogation in London, and he was grilled by Peter Wright of MI5, who, of course, went on and wrote the book Spycatcher in the 1980s, in which he sort of laid out this supposedly damning case against Dick Ellis. And, you know, I went and investigated essentially kind of, you know, what the grounds were for Ellis being a Nazi and Soviet spy, and came to the conclusion that there really wasn't much to suggest that he was a spy for either of those enemies during the war or even before the war, and that Ellis may have actually been protecting his boss at MI6. Essentially, my feeling is that, and the evidence would show that MI6 was in fact sort of cooperating with sort of elements of Nazi Germany before the outbreak of the Second World War, and this was a deeply embarrassing thing for Great Britain.
An accusation that boggles the mind that you just noted is the notion that Ellis was working for the Soviet KGB. You write this in the book, and I quote, "The issue of whether Ellis's confession exists, I suspect it does in some form, perhaps more of an inconclusive interview than a full-blown admission of guilt, obscures what is really the core issue. The whole circumstantial case against Ellis is so doubtful that he deserves the benefit of the doubt. He was another victim of the Cold War when hysteria and fear overtook sense and reason, when paranoid intelligence agencies on both sides of the Atlantic were utterly convinced that there were other Philbys to be uncovered." End quote. You go on to say that even if there was a confession, and of course we don't know if there was, it has to be backed up with evidence. You've gone more deeply into this issue than pretty much any other author ever has. Have you uncovered any evidence? And if you have, what was it? Was it anything more than circumstantial?
Well, I mean, the allegations made against Ellis are absolutely crazy, really. Essentially that he sort of sold, you know, the Nazis, the organizational structure of MI6, that, you know, he basically provided the Nazis all the sort of the intelligence that they needed before the invasion of Britain. You know, that Dick Ellis has been sort of linked to the deaths of you know, an actor, Leslie Howard, all sorts of stuff. And really, I mean, what Ellis is supposed to have confessed to is accepting money at some point when he was a field agent for MI6 in Western Europe, and that he had accepted some money in exchange for some intelligence. But the thing that Dick Ellis was involved in was, in fact, you know, he was involved in selling intelligence, but, you know, the job of an intelligence officer in the field is sometimes to sell your enemies false information, and or to convince your enemy that you can be bought, and you know, that you can become a double agent for an enemy power. So my feeling is that that Dick Ellis was heavily involved in working against the Soviet Union prior to the Second World War, that, you know, the common enemy of the Germans and the British was the Soviet Union. And so Dick Ellis was involved in basically, you know, gaining contacts in the Russian community that was against the Soviet Union, you know, the White Russians or the Ukrainians, who had sort of been dispossessed after the Russian Revolution and who wanted to see an end to communism. So he was involved, I guess, in some sort of horse trading of intelligence, and at some point possibly accepted some money, which he then spent on himself or his family. And my feeling is that in the context of his entire life and the contribution that he made to Western intelligence, to, you know, to the war effort in the First World War and the Second World War, for his contribution to the United States, to the setting up of the, you know, what became the CIA and the Australian intelligence services, that he should be given for this indiscretion.
Jesse, thank you for bringing us these insights into Dick Ellis's life. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with international best-selling author Jesse Fink about British spymaster Dick Ellis. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with acclaimed international best-selling author Jesse Fink, who has recently published the absolutely outstanding book, The Eagle in the Mirror, The Greatest Spy Story Never Told. Jesse, welcome back. Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks, Mike.
Jesse, as I said at the start of the program, Dick Ellis was given more honors, awards, and medals than we even have time to list on this show. How is it that somebody so important, so integral to the Allied victory in the Second World War, so critical to the creation of American spy agencies, be so largely forgotten? How is that possible? Why is he not among the pantheon of great intelligence officers?
Well, I guess, you know, what a great intelligence officer does is stay quiet. You know, that's part of the job, is not to reveal too much about what it is that you do. And he managed to not only, you know, win these decorations and awards, but he wrote two books, including a very important book on the League of Nations. He was a scholar of some repute about Central Asia. He was a polyglot, a classical musician. He served as the deputy to William Stevenson at British Security Coordination in the United States. And, of course, Stevenson, you know, liked publicising his own exploits. But Dick Ellis was, you know, quite the opposite. He was someone who really sort of adhered to the Official Secrets Act and didn't want to get in trouble for kind of, you know, writing too much about the things that he was involved with. So investigating his life and trying to sort of put together a picture of exactly who he was extremely difficult. But he was always in the background of, you know, these major events. So he was kind of like, you know, the Zelig of British intelligence. But he was connected to so many important people and to so many, and you know, massive organisations and made such a huge contribution to you know, the victory of the Allies in the Second World War, that I was just astonished that no one had ever attempted to really kind of put his life together in book form. But what I quickly discovered was, you know, there was a reason for that, because it was very hard to find anything about him.
I want to get back to these unfounded allegations that Ellis spied for the Soviet KGB. Where do these allegations originate? You make a point of saying in the book that there was never any proof that this happened, that Ellis adamantly denied it, and that he was allowed to retire quickly, keep his pension, and live happily ever after. Where did this rumor come from, and what do you think the motivation was in spreading it?
Well, I mean, like I said before, you know, this Nazi officer's interrogation report was passed on to, you know, Kim Philby. And Kim Philby said he didn't have any idea who Dick Ellis was, even though they shared office space in London at that time. So, you know, decades later, when this particular report sort of was produced, when MI6 and the CIA were, you know, scrambling to find if there were any other Soviet moles in the intelligence services of the UK and the USA, this report was looked upon very suspiciously. And it was basically thought that, you know, Philby was protecting Ellis. And, you know, what would the reason be for Philby to protect Ellis? You know, were they working in cahoots? You know, was Ellis this sort of Russian super spy that hadn't been detected? It seemed to be a very sort of simple explanation for what, you know, Philby had written on this particular report.
I would also want to revisit this notion that Ellis may have fallen on his sword to protect a superior. He may have made, perhaps, let's call it a partial confession, only in order to protect someone above him, perhaps even the head of MI6 at the time. Who would that have been, and what would have been the motivation in protecting this person?
Well, there was a guy called Stuart Mingus, you know, which is spelled Menzies, but they pronounce it Mingus. So he was the head of MI6 at the time. You know, Ellis was working for him. Mingus was actually in close contact with Admiral Canaris of the Abwehr, who was one of the main conspirators against Hitler. So, you know, the actual, you know, the Nazi officer who had mentioned this Captain Ellis when he had been interrogated had been the deputy of Canaris. So, you know, Ellis being in contact with this Nazi officer called Plotzer and Mingus being in contact with Canaris would suggest that there was some sort of level of cooperation or collaboration between Nazi Germany and Great Britain prior to the outbreak of the Second World War. And of course, after the outbreak of the Second World War, Nazi Germany and Great Britain were mortal enemies. So I think that it was highly embarrassing for MI6, and Dick Ellis understood that if he had sort of, you know, sort of admitted to collaborating with the Germans or sort of acting under the orders of Stuart Mingus to essentially work very closely with Nazi Germany prior to the Second World War, it would have opened a whole can of worms for Stuart Mingus. And he died a few years after Ellis's confession. And, you know, Mingus was a supporter of Ellis right up until Mingus's death. He sort of promoted him and sort of encouraged people to continue working with Ellis. He never stopped supporting him. His loyalty was always with Ellis, and Ellis's loyalty was always with Mingus. And that is, I think, the most logical explanation for what Ellis was involved in when it came to his contacts with Nazi Germany. He didn't want to sort of give up Mingus and get him to explain something that wouldn't have been easily explained, you know, 2 decades after the end of the Second World War.
After Ellis died, his family attempted to clear his name. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, however, refused at the time to either confirm or deny the accusations against Ellis that Pinscher had made. That caused Ellis's daughter, Anne Salwey, to return the medals that her father had been given to the British government. Was Ellis ever formally exonerated? And if not, why not?
No, he wasn't ever formally exonerated, even though his daughter had written to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Margaret Thatcher, and asked her to make a statement. And Thatcher refused, essentially, by saying, you know, that if she were to, you know, make this exception for Ellis, that she would have to comment on other cases, and she wasn't prepared to do that. So the Ellis family never got the resolution and the exoneration that they were seeking for their deceased father. And I know that Anne, his daughter, was so disgusted with the British government, she actually returned his medals, and she left the UK, went to live in the United States. Ellis's son, Peter, who was a Canadian intelligence officer, he also wouldn't accept that his father was guilty and had, you know, would spend years and years trying to clear his name. And only this week I was contacted by someone who actually knew Peter Ellis and said that, you know, Peter Ellis had been deeply disgusted by the fact that his father had been betrayed essentially by the Americans and the British, and that his name had been sullied in the way that it's been sullied. So it's a pretty sort of sad tale, really, and I think it's sort of symptomatic of kind of how the media works these days, is that, you know, people make allegations, then people, you know, repeat the allegations, it gets reported somewhere else, and no one ever actually bothers to actually try and figure out whether it's true in the first place. So, you know, that's what I've tried to do with this book, is present a fairer kind of account of, you know, what Ellis was involved in, who he was, and sort of ask readers to make up their own mind about, you know, his guilt or innocence.
Thank you, Jesse. You were fantastic, and so is the story of Dick Ellis. Everybody loves a good spy story. I know I do. I always have. But what makes spy stories so great is that they're either true or they're based on truth. This story is different. Dick Ellis was a patriot. That's what the evidence shows. He was not a spy. He was not a traitor. And rather than having highly paid writers make their money by denigrating the memory of the man, he should be celebrated. I'd like to thank our guest, Jesse Fink, for being with us today. And thank you to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack at John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.